Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. You have to have your head virtually in the sand or some other dark place to not understand that human activity is rapidly warming our planet, imperiling our very future. While the current administration seems to be waging a virtual war on climate science in this country, there are still fine climate scientists working to help us understand this consequential issue. Our guest is one of those people. Isabel Montañez is a paleoclimatologist, distinguished professor, and Chancellor's Leadership Professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. Her expertise is in the field of using geochemistry to tap into how the Earth's climate has evolved in response to changes in atmospheric carbon deep into the geologic past. A recent study that Montañez co-authored with colleagues from the Chinese Academy of Sciences and Texas A&M examines a period of dramatic warming due to naturally caused carbon burps, sudden increases of CO2, 300 million years ago. The study offers a window into how the planet responds to changes in atmospheric chemistry. And while this period of warming happened over many millennia, our current planetary warming is happening over a much shorter period of time. Dr. Montañez and I will explore how modern science studies the climate of Earth's past and how it might inform what we are observing with our current climate crisis. She joins us now from UC Davis. Isabel Montañez, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I'd like to start out by learning a little bit about you and your background. I see that you were born in Switzerland. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So my mother is Swiss and my father, who is Colombian, was at university in Geneva and he met my mother. So she was the only one making an income. And we lived there until I moved to the UK, actually, where I learned English as a young child.
And when did you come to the United States?
In 1972.
And where was that?
We moved to Philadelphia. I've been moving west my entire life, so looking forward to retiring in Fiji.
Yes. Well, now you're at UC Davis. When did you get there?
So I started, my whole career has been at UC. I started out at Riverside in 1990 and then came to Davis at 1998.
Tell us about how you first got interested in science and math, and then how that morphed into becoming interested in Earth history and the climate of the past.
Yeah, so I think I always knew that I wanted to do something quantitative, and by that I mean I was one of those kids who liked A equals plus B equals C very straightforwardly and very clearly. And I struggled actually with things that were more artistic or even language learning. I did much better if I could just see it very clearly as essentially an equation. And then my father really enjoyed the outdoors. And so we would spend weekends in Pennsylvania looking at rocks. And these were rocks that formed when Africa and North America essentially became one continent 300 million years ago. And we would find all kinds of weird things that now I know why they were weird, but he just thought it was fun to be outdoors and I thought it was great to find these fossils. And so I thought I wanted to be a paleontologist and I actually did that in college. I still wanted to do that. And then I worked at the Smithsonian for 2 years as essentially a lackey and in the collections, and came to realize that wasn't for me, but what was for me was the geochemistry, because that brought the equations together, it brought the environment, and it brought the whole Earth system together. And I just was fascinated by, wow, you could learn about the Earth system however many millions of years or thousands of years ago that you might be interested in.
And it's really interesting listening to your story, because I hear a variation of it so often that it's parents encouraging young kids to be out in nature and explore, and that tends to always spark that curiosity. So many scientists I've talked to over the years share that similar kind of origin story, and I think that's very cool.
I think it's hard to know what it would be to be a scientist unless you have someone sort of promoting it, you know, by giving you firsthand experiences.
Yeah, especially just out in the outdoors, as I like to tell people, you know, science is really just all about trying to understand the natural world, nature. It's the ultimate expression of trying to figure out how does this awesome machinery of nature, as Carl Sagan put it, how does it work? I love that.
I say all the time, I'm a forensic scientist, and I get paid to discover, and it's really fun.
Well, let's talk a bit about the tools that you use to discover and your colleagues, because it's very interesting to think about the Earth's climate and how it has changed through time. So let's talk a bit about the tools you use, the proxies. Let's start with that term. What does that mean, proxy?
Yeah, so proxies are a representation of some past process or condition where we don't have the luxury of being able to actually witness or observe the process or measure its impact. So, for example, rainfall. You know, we can't monitor rainfall in the past unless we can collect it. And so when you get past the time, historic time, when we've been measuring temperature or capturing rainfall or looking at how much snow is accumulated, that goes back only as far as humans have been actually taking records and measurements, at best 100 years. So as you go further back, whether it be hundreds of years or literally hundreds of millions of years ago, we have to fall back on these proxies, these representations. And I think the way to look at a proxy is it is something we can measure in the lab, but we have to really understand how that proxy was imprinted by the process that we're after. So how do we know that when we measure some geochemical value of a mineral or a fossil shell, how do we know that it's just temperature? Or is it temperature and the water conditions, the chemistry of the water? And that's what makes proxies a bit challenging, because we really have to understand how the process is imprinted on the proxy.
And let's talk about, take us through a list of the proxies that we use, starting with the ones that perhaps people are more familiar with for looking at climate in the past that's not as far back as we're going to go, you know, as we discuss this, but things like trees.
Yeah. So there are many, many proxies, right? So if we look at, let's just say we wanted to know about the medieval times when we here in the West may have seen a drought very similar to the bad drought that sort of culminated in the 2020, 2021 in our recent past. There are lots of proxies we can go to. We can go to trees, and there we look at the rings, the growth rings in the trees, and see whether those rings will vary in their thickness by how much water is available to the tree. And so when they're water stressed, they'll look very different than when they're happy with lots of normal rainfall. We can also do chemical analyses on those. We can go to caves, and some of the work we do is to work in California caves where you actually monitor the cave and you do know how the rainfall and the temperature outside ultimately imprints on the cave formations that we then measure and analyze. There, you know, you can look at seasonal changes in rainfall. You can look at whether temperatures outside changed dramatically. You can look at past wildfire that is kind of crystallized in the cave formations. You can look at fossil drip water that went from the soil into the cave and then gets captured in these growing cave formations.
That has a cool name too, doesn't it? Is it speleothems?
Yeah, so speleothems are everything. They are the things that hang from the ceiling, but those are actually stalactites. And they're the things that grow from the floor, formations up, and those are stalagmites. We only use the latter, the stalagmites.
Why is that?
Basically because the ones that are forming from the ceiling, you can actually see this if you visit a cave, they'll often have like a little drip water hanging on the bottom.
Oh, yes.
The problem is that drip of water is hanging there for potentially hours or days, and it's evaporating. And so what forms from it is not a very true proxy of what is really in the water or outside in the environment. It's recording that thing evaporating just right there on the tip. And the ones on the bottom, next time people go into a cave, if they look at the top of these formations growing on the cave floor, they'll notice they're wet. And in fact, they usually have a nice layer of water on them, very thin layer. So that means that stalagmite is growing always wet, and it really is recording what that water is. It's not evaporating there and degassing.
Okay, well, so we have trees and caves, and then what next?
So the other big one on land is lakes, getting cores through lakes. And those typically have annual layers. All of these, by the way, look like tree rings. They all have typically annual layers. So that's kind of cool, right? You can get seasonal and annual changes, whether you want it from a cave, the nearby forest and its trees, or a nearby lake and its core. Those are the main ones from land.
And of course, UC Davis has, quite a research center up there at Lake Tahoe. So I imagine there's some very interesting work being done there to study the climate of the past, using the sediment cores from Lake Tahoe.
Well, so you picked the right person to ask that to. Unfortunately, not. Those researchers who are part of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center are more interested in the present lake system, and understandably so. How is that lake responding to changes in climate, into algal blooms that are causing problems, changes in water runoff into the lake, sediment runoff? But there are few studies that have been done looking at the past from Lake Tahoe. And the reason I said you asked the right person, one of those, I think it's two studies. One of them was from my husband did. There have been some nice studies done there looking at paleo earthquake events. University of Nevada, Reno has done some very cool work. But past climates, that's been pretty limited. But there are a couple.
Okay, well, that covers the land then. What about the oceans?
Well, and I guess I figured I missed one big land one.
Ooh, well, let's get that one in.
Ice cores.
Yes, certainly.
So ice cores are phenomenal, right? And so we now have a couple dozen beautiful ice cores from Antarctica and Greenland. Those are key, but none of them go back much more than a million years. No problem. That's a long time, but that means we lose that proxy once we go further back.
Yeah, and a million years is a long time to you and me, but in terms of geologic time, it's nothing.
No, it isn't. And the other thing about ice cores is that, I think if people think about snowpack, how do you form ice? Well, you literally compact the snow, right? You build it up. You may have 50 feet. You may have ultimately 1,000 feet of ice. And then it becomes compacted. And as it compacts, it squeezes out air. It squeezes out even some water. And it becomes ice. But the problem is then ice cores, that kind of distorts the proxy record. And so ice cores are great for some things, but they kind of become less useful after a few tens of thousands of years.
And then once we go beyond ice, I would imagine out in the oceans, sediment cores would be, one of the most important proxies out there.
Sediment cores are definitely very useful, but they have to come from the deep ocean.
Why is that?
If you go to the margins, if you went to off the coast of California, we have a shelf that extends several miles outward from land. But there's just too much activity going on there, right? You have sediment running off from rivers. You have erosion, the wind. You have all kinds of organisms just happy as they can be on the seafloor and burrowing in to the sediment. So those are very complex records and
aren't too dynamic.
Too dynamic. Exactly. Well put. you go out to the deep ocean, and at that point, you're still dealing with some of those things, but far less. And so you have the likelihood of preserving layers. The problem is that you still have no better than maybe 1,000, 1,500 years of temporal resolution, meaning you really can't discern 10 years from another 10 years. You can tell what happened 1,000 years and 1,000 years after that and 1,000 years after that, but you're not going to get the yearly or seasonal records you get from caves, lakes, tree rings, and younger ice cores.
And then how far back in geologic time can you get with the deep sea sediments?
Oh, I think they're as far back as about 200 million years. Mm. And the only limitation for them to go further back is that those old seafloors don't exist anymore.
Yes, because of plate tectonics.
Yeah, exactly. They're under continents. There is one ocean one that we missed, and it does give you the same resolution, time resolution, as caves and tree rings and lakes, and that is corals. And so there's quite a bit of nice work that's been done over the past decades where they can look at the growth rings in corals and get it past temperature, past sea, ocean circulation. How healthy is the ocean?
pH.
Yeah, all those things.
Interesting. Well, and I remember doing some research when I was in college for a paper I was writing about the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction event. And the foraminifera were just one of the most important proxies when I was studying that. Could tell us about them, because they're an important proxy, aren't they?
They very much are.
Tell us what they are.
Yeah, so foraminifera are calcified, meaning the skeleton, it's an external shell, basically, is made of calcium and carbonate, effectively like marble, like limestone. But these are unicellular, one-cell plants that are growing in the ocean. They're a phytoplankton. I should have said, you said foraminifer, but we use both. The plants are coccoliths. They are these beautifully ornate shells, and they have one cell of plant life inside of them. They float by the cajillions on the ocean's surface. So when they die, they probably live about 2 weeks or so. When they die, they sink to the bottom of the seafloor. And so these cores that you mentioned, the sediment cores, all those layers will have layers of these collected coccoliths. So those are very useful. And it's the chemistry of them that will tell us temperature and pH and salinity. Again, reconstructing circulation and even atmospheric CO2. The foraminifera are also single-celled, but they're animals. And they produce these beautiful shells, also of calcium carbonate. Many of them float on the surface ocean. Some are more swimming in the water column. But they too, with them, I'm not quite sure if it's weeks or months, but when they die, they fall to the bottom and they collect in these layers as well. And they're used very similarly for the same sort of information.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our examination of climate change through Earth history with Isabel Montañez from the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we look at climate change and Earth's past with UC Davis paleoclimatologist Isabel Montañez. And let's dive into the chemistry part, because I know that interests you, because people always want to know, how do they know that? When we're talking about analyzing the chemistry, the geochemistry here, tell us about what it is exactly that you're looking at and looking for. Let's break that down a bit and talk about, you know, when you're looking at ratios of isotopes, for example. Tell us about how you use those to understand what was going on back so long ago.
Yeah. So for many, many decades, we've looked at the oxygen and the carbon isotopes of all these things we've talked about, and sometimes even the hydrogen isotopes. Why? Because those are the water. They're the atmospheric CO2, carbon, right? CO2. Those are sort of conventional proxies. But in the last three decades, I'd say, pretty much in the 2000s, there has been this just explosion of people's abilities and machines that allow us to look at the isotopes of a lot of the periodic table. We can do isotopes of uranium, of lead, of tungsten, of chromium, barium, lithium. I mean, the list goes on. And when we have this potential, we can look at so many things in the environment.
And when we're talking about isotopes, just for those of us who don't perhaps have the chemistry background that you and I do, isotopes are just the same element, say carbon or oxygen, but they have a different number of neutrons in their nucleus, which makes them a little heavier or lighter, but they're still the same element. It's still carbon. People have probably heard of carbon-14, which is heavier than the normal carbon-12 that's, you know, your the graphite in your pencil.
Right, right. And there's a 13 in there in the middle. Yep, that's exactly right. And like, you know, water, I always think water is a good one to use as an example. Mm-hmm. Most people think water is water, right? It's made up of hydrogen and oxygen, right? But they don't realize that it ranges in its mass or how much it weighs from 16 to 22 because there are three different isotopes of oxygen and there are two of hydrogen. So when you can think of all the combinations you can put together where you come up with a weight of 16 versus a weight of 22.
And your most common one would be 18, right?
Exactly. So how does it work? Effectively, when natural processes happen, whether it's warming, the air gets warmer or the seawater gets warmer, or the pH goes down in the seawater, or the atmospheric CO2 goes up or goes down, or it's rainier or drier, all of those processes cause isotopes to do something we call fractionate, which means that the heavier isotope, there's always a heavier and a lighter. Sometimes there's four isotopes, but one will be the most heavy, one will be the least heavy. And they will separate out. One will stay in the water and the air, and the other one will go into the shell, or go into the tree, or go into whatever is mineral is forming on the seafloor, lake floor, cave. And this process of fractionation of isotopes of different masses is something that we've come to now fully understand, and that's by monitoring modern systems. That's the only way we can really know. How do we know that? Because if we go to the cave and we collect the rainwater passing through the soil, passing through the top of the cave, collect it, measure it. We know what the air temperatures are outside and in the cave. We know what the water isotopes are, and we can grow calcite on literally a glass plate. And we can say, oh, in this cave, in this location, we are seeing this amount of fractionation for each degree temperature change. And that's how we can know how to interpret the proxies. And that has to be done in the ocean, it has to be done in lakes, and it's done for trees and ice.
Okay, so comment a little bit more on how you've seen the technology and the ability to use these proxies, like you said, now across the periodic table, how that really has evolved during your career and how it's really shaped our ability to really probe the past.
Yes, and that's what's been, I think, the highlight of my career, or one of them, I should say there are others, but is to have just experienced this revolution in technology. And of course, I can only speak from the geochemical perspective. That might be true for those who do other kinds of work. But in geochemistry, it's been a revolution in two ways. It's the machinery. We can now do just incredibly small amounts of material. So you mentioned a foraminifera. Used to be that you had to have about 100 foraminifera from the same layer, or if you were lucky, maybe it had to be from 5 layers in order to be able to analyze it and get a meaningful number, which meant that if you had to do 5 layers, you had to mix the time represented. You were averaging out the time of those 5 layers. So at best, you might have said, well, in this 100-year period, it was warmer than this 100-year period. We're now at the point, and this is just one example, where you could take a foram and you can take each of the sections of its shell. You could do 20 analyses on one little microfossil shell that is no bigger than a few hundred microns. It actually can be, some of these things are no bigger than the width of a few hairs, a person's hair. And so that's incredible what we can do. But it's also not just the size of the samples that can be done. It's now the breadth of the elements that we can analyze. And one of my favorite stories, mostly because it gives my dissertation advisor a hard time, is that when I was finishing up in the very late 1980s, finishing up my dissertation, one day I said, it would be incredible if we could do the isotopes of magnesium. And he just started howling, laughing. And a couple of the guys in the lab were like, ha, ha, look at her. Well, everybody does magnesium isotopes of everything now.
And what allowed that? What was the technological evolution that allowed that to happen that proved you right?
So it's these mass spectrometers. It's these machines that, and there are different kinds of mass spectrometers, but you can tell from the name mass spectrometer that they're separating the masses of the isotopes. And so there are these machines now that can take very small samples, and with great precision, they can tell you how many isotopes of 13 carbon or 14 carbon or 238 uranium versus 232, this sort of thing. They can tell you very precisely how many atoms of a given element and its isotope is there versus the other isotope. And that's what has allowed us to get at this much higher precision and ability to get data of this type.
Well, let's talk about Earth history a bit now that we know about the tools that we're using to understand this. Can you kind of give us some of the interesting highlights through geologic time of how the climate has changed and the atmospheric composition? For example, there was a time on Earth, a very long period of time, when there was no oxygen in the atmosphere.
Yeah, of course. So if we go really far back, I mean, 4.6 billion years, the Earth was really a magma ocean. There were no continents. A really, really juvenile planet. And so that was a very different world, right? There was no oxygen. There's still some debate as to why we started getting oxygen. You know, the easy answer is always, well, that the evolution of photosynthesizing single-celled plants in the ocean are what created oxygen.
What other mechanisms could there be?
The possibility can be that if you, especially these times where you had a lot of ice covering the Earth. So there are these times, probably 4 times in the very deep past, as early as almost a billion years ago, and then as most recent as I think it's about 580 million years ago. There seems to have been about 4 of these periods where the continents, where the world was covered by ice. Maybe not 100%, but much of it. It is possible that inorganic chemical reactions and maybe the very earliest single-celled plants deep in water could have started to produce some oxygen. That is possible. But it's the ice covering the land and the oceans that would have allowed it to accumulate. So if this were like this for hundreds of thousands or millions of years until that ice melted catastrophically and released the gases caught in the ocean, then you could build up some oxygen that normally you would not have built up. And when you release that, that may have been what spurred the evolution of much broader a scale photosynthesis. It's very debated. I don't think there's any consensus on that, for instance. But if I step it back out, you said it, we didn't have oxygen. We had higher CO2 in the atmosphere. And it's probably about 400 million years ago when our oceans finally became oxygenated. So even the ocean was probably not very rich in oxygen until then. The atmosphere may have started having sufficient oxygen for life, you know, well before that, probably more like 550 million years ago. But since that time, since the ocean became more like today's ocean, where it circulated, not that unsimilar to today, whenever the continents are configured differently, of course, you know, circulation has to be different, but since that time, about 400 and some so million years ago, things weren't that different. You started having land plants. You started having ice sheets, maybe in slightly different locations than today. But a system, an Earth system that we can better understand because we understand our modern one. And during that time from 400 so million years ago to today, we've still had major changes. We've had major changes in atmospheric CO2. We've had major changes in the sort of temperature state, the mean, we call it the mean, the average temperature around the globe on any given year, sort of state.
And when you look at those changes in that state, do we see any kind of analogs to what's occurring now? I know you just did a really interesting study about these burps, and let's talk about that, of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Sure.
It kind of can be used to study what's going on now with us producing the carbon dioxide. Tell us about some of those events. What would be the sources of carbon dioxide? You know, I know volcanic eruptions can cause that, fires. What are some of the sources that would cause these emissions of carbon before there were humans?
Yeah, exactly. So I do have to say one funny little story. I did a paper last year with colleagues that was published, I think, October last year. And we had a graph in there. And the bottom line was we did the temperatures over Earth for the last 485 million years. But these were done on the million-year timescale, right? We just wanted to show how the state we're in now is a fragile climate state where you have ice sheets and it's cooler than many times in the past. But during those times, you had dinosaurs and you had terrifically double the temperatures on land than you do today and so on. And that went viral last 2 weeks ago, I think.
Really?
Because Joe Rogan used one of the graphs from that paper to really harass Bernie Sanders on his podcast, saying, look, today is a global cooling compared to the past.
this is that old cliche that they use. Well, the Earth's climate's always been changing.
Yeah, well, this one was, we're in a cooling. Yes, we're in a cooling. So they'll use that as a segue to what you asked about the burps. So I have spent the last 15 or so years really trying to understand the whole Earth system for the last time we had ice sheets on Earth to the extent we do today. I think most people don't realize that until about 32 million years ago, we didn't live in an Earth anything like today. Yeah, the continents weren't that different in terms of where they were positioned, but we had no ice in what is Antarctica or in Greenland. And it was a much warmer Earth. So I'm very interested in this past time period. It's 300 million years ago. It's actually about 340 million years to about 290 million years ago.
So looking at my geologic timescale, that's the Paleozoic. Is that like the Carboniferous period?
Yeah, Carboniferous and the early Permian. And this is the time when we had ice at the poles. We had CO2 in the atmosphere, not much unlike what it was 200 years ago and where it may be by the end of this century. It ranged in that window of levels of CO2. And we don't have any other time equivalent periods that had animals and plants and atmospheric ocean circulation similar to, in general, to today. So I've spent a lot of time trying to understand this time period because it's really our only, I don't want to say analog because that's too much, but it's our only window into how does an ice house, a time with ice at both poles and overall cooler temperatures, how does it respond to global warming? And this time period had multiple events of global warming superimposed on it. So the burps are five of those global warming events superimposed on, imagine, the Earth's system of 200 years ago, before we started burning fossil fuels.
And the burps are higher emissions of carbon dioxide?
They are, exactly. And these emissions, back then, the amount of CO2 that was released during these five burps that we identified, and we see them in the ocean, that's where they're best recorded. But these burps of CO2, there probably was some methane in there too, but mostly carbon dioxide. They were rises in CO2 of similar amount as what we anticipate in the next several decades, starting at levels similar to before humans burned fossil fuels. So in that way, they are very much analogous. The difference is that—
Time scale.
So these took tens to hundreds of thousands of years for the burps to completely play out. And we're doing it on, a century or less.
Decadal.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's one of the things when they make that, those kinds of people make that argument about, well, the climate's always changed. Not at the rate that it's changing now, correct?
That's right. We are doing a geologic experiment, but at two orders or more faster rate.
Is there anything that you can suss out from your geochemistry data to indicate what the possible sources are of these burps?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of carbon isotopes because carbon has the fingerprint of whatever was in the CO2 or what was in the methane, CH4. We can, from the fingerprints of the carbon, the record that's left in the proxies, and then modeling. We always use modeling to help us better interpret what we can measure. The modeling helps us sort of see what's the possibility, right? It tells us, well, it could have been 75% CO2 from a volcano. It could have been another 25% from methane leaking from lakes that became anoxic and were drying up and were too warm. That's the kind of thing we can do with the modeling. We can't do that just from the isotopes. We can tell that there was something in that range. And that's what we did in this study. We used the modeling to help us better understand what the sources could have been. And in this case, it's easily explainable by volcanic eruptions that were happening around these continents that were suturing together. And they were releasing a lot of volcanic, a lot of volcanism.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's also quite interesting to me to think about this in terms of, okay, you've got these carbon burps. I'm wondering, is there any evidence or can you look at that of changes in the fossil record biodiversity during these periods of time?
So yes, the lead author on this paper was actually a postdoc of mine for 3 years, and he got very involved in the geochemistry as part of why he came to my lab. But he comes from a group in Nanjing, the Institute of Geology and Paleontology, and they have done really, I think, some of the best work for a lot of the deep time, including this time period, where they've looked at biodiversity records across the Earth, and they can see these changes, drops in biodiversity. And so effectively, it's not an extinction, but what it's telling us is that the waters were stressed, the ecosystems were stressed, and some really thrived, but that when it recovered from being stressed, the diversity was down because probably some life forms died, and the ones that survived kind of, they were able to deal with this, but the degree of diversity of life was just low for a while until it all recovered.
After a short break, we'll be back for more as UC Davis Distinguished Professor and Paleoclimatologist Isabel Montañez and I explore climate change through geologic time. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we examine the science behind understanding climate change through geologic history with distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis, Isabel Montañez. And when you have these carbon burps, just like what we're observing today, it leads to all kinds of different environmental effects. Acidification of the ocean, which harms corals. We're seeing that playing out across the planet. Of course, just a very interesting events happening, in the news, where you get these, tremendous rainfall events because the warmer atmosphere can hold more water. It's interesting to think about, those things playing out before there were humans on Earth.
They did. And undoubtedly, they can be explained by volcanism often. You're releasing a lot of carbon dioxide, or it can be from methane in the deep ocean, methane ice that warms as the ocean warms. But these things, yes, they could all happen tomorrow. They could happen in the next 50 years. The difference is they cannot explain what we're seeing currently because the volcanism is at a low point. The oceans are not releasing their methane ice. So yes, these are natural processes, but there is no evidence for their existing in this particular past 100 years, few hundreds of years.
Yet it's frustrating and interesting to me at the same time to think about the fingerprints of what's going on with the atmosphere right now and our increasing carbon level. It's pretty obvious, where that carbon dioxide's coming from.
Yeah,
it's not a mystery, and yet there are still some naysayer type people trying to claim that, oh, this is, part of a natural cycle. Well, Joe Rogan, who I'm sure has a degree in planetary sciences, is an expert.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you, of course. The interesting thing is, you said, and I'm sure but maybe sharing with everyone else, there's no question the CO2 in the atmosphere today, the methane, which quickly becomes CO2 within a decade or so, or a couple decades. When you look at the isotopes, the carbon isotopes of those gases in the atmosphere today, they have a substantially lower value that can only come from fossil fuels. So there's no question. We can tell you how much of the gases came from burning of oil and gas. So that should be just not disputable. And we've known from studying the past and physics and models and everything you can imagine. There's just so much proof that has been built over decades that when you increase these gases of carbon dioxide and methane that are capable of effectively holding more of the sun's heat or the heat coming radiating from the Earth's surface, the heat we create when we burn fossil fuels or when we anything that creates friction. We produce this heat, and these gases are exceptionally good at holding that heat. And that's why we call them greenhouse gases. And so they create a greenhouse effect on Earth's surface. So there should be no argument that that is the fact. We are going to warm when we have more of these gases. And I think we just don't teach that early enough in schools. If we were to teach this to kindergartners, and again, first and third and fifth and eighth graders and so on, I just think we would have a different perspective. And it wouldn't be political as opposed to just factual.
It's not really that complicated from a physics and chemistry point of view. It's really rather simple.
Exactly.
And yet it becomes very complicated because of the word you just used, the P word, politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was a science educator for 30 years at the secondary level. And, you know, I was always amazed at the students coming to me in high school. It just they had like zero science background from elementary school, or very little, unless they had a really great teacher. And that's kind of a rarity.
Well, you said it. I'm glad you said it. You're not making me say it. It is. I don't think we pay our teachers enough. We don't respect the profession sufficiently, which probably goes hand in hand with the pay. And so to get really dedicated teachers, they're doing it not for the money, not for the career opportunities. They're doing it out of the goodness of their heart and a true passion for that. That's hard, right? That's hard to propagate it at scale. I don't know why. So I had my primary school education in the UK. Yes, it was a private school, and that's a different story. But I came to the United States, and the first thing I learned was, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, I learned that 4 years ago. Why are we not doing this? Why are we not doing that? I don't understand why the American system it's really not at the level of the system, the school systems in many other countries. I suspect that's true in China, Japan, and probably many other places. And I don't know why. We don't seem to put enough money into our educational system. It doesn't seem to be a high enough priority. And I think for California, for example, you could not get credit for having had like earth or environmental sciences, right, in the school system. That didn't count towards one of the criteria, like the A through G.
Yeah.
But now finally, I think it just made it through in the last couple of years. But again, we're sending the message that it's not critical science, right?
Yeah.
Not
for many years, I taught physics and chemistry. And those are the kids that are going to go to places like CSU Chico or UC Davis or UCLA,
mm-hmm.
or many of the schools that those students went off to that kept in touch with me.
Exactly.
And then I also taught earth science, and those students were not on that track. Very rarely would they go on to, you know, any kind of college, and certainly it would be extremely rare for them to go into anything like a technical field like the sciences. And yet, those earth sciences, those are the gateway. Those are the most interesting things, the astronomy and the geology. Those are things that those physics and chemistry students don't even really get exposed to. It's kind of backwards.
That's right. No, that's exactly the issue. And I think there's a cultural component as well. And, you know, my father being a Latino, my family, extended family on that side, I can't tell you how many times they said to me, if you're smart enough to get a PhD, why the heck would you not be a doctor or an engineer? But what, a geologist? So I do think we don't expose young people. I mean, if you come from a family who you're first generation and you're telling your parents that in the summer you're required to go camp in the middle of nowhere to learn to identify rocks, they're probably not going to be real pleased about that when you might be working that summer and making money, right? Saving it or helping with the family. So I think we haven't done over the past few generations a very good job of selling the science either.
Well, what do you have on the horizon for the future? Any interesting research coming up along these lines before we let you go?
Yeah, so I'm deeply involved in using weathering of silicate minerals, you know, the good old classic geology process, one of Earth's oldest chemical reactions, where water in the rain, CO2 in the atmosphere mix to dissolve the volcanic material, and they sequester CO2 from the atmosphere in the process of doing that. So we are running trials throughout California in rangeland, cropland, where we spread ground volcanic rock and till it into the ground and monitor how that weathering process is removing CO2 actively from the atmosphere today.
So another way to sequester some CO2.
Yeah, because eventually we hope it goes down into the groundwater, rivers, into the ocean, where it can make more shells and be sequestered for millions of years.
Very, very cool. Well, on that nice hopeful note, Isabel Montañez, paleoclimatologist and distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. Thanks for joining us on Blue Dot. This was just fascinating. What a great tour through Earth history and the tools that you use.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, paleoclimatologist, distinguished professor, and Chancellor's Leadership Professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis, and director of the UC Davis Institute for the Environment, Isabel Montañez. You can learn more about their work at environment.ucdavis.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.